Hi again, it's Shelby with Hooks, Books, and Crime, and it's Crafting Storytime, where I crochet and tell you a terrible story. If you're into true crime, if you like to craft and crochet and listen to true crime, let me be your girl. I'm going to be covering a horrible serial killer today, and as usual, crafting. Let's get started. We are in Dallas, Texas, 1990. The weather is relatively warm for December, and the city is at the height of its crime rate. Murders, armed robberies, burglaries are nightly activities. In December 1990, 33-year-old Mary Pratt was a sex worker who frequented Jefferson Boulevard, a common street in Oak Cliff for women of the night. Mary was in this life because of her addiction to drugs and was trying to dig herself out of her situation. One night, she was working and was picked up by a man looking to use her services, and that was the last time she was seen alive. The next morning, Mary was found a good distance from where she was working. She was found dumped in a residential area, still in Oak Cliff, right off the street like trash, with a gunshot wound. She was partially clothed and had been splayed out as if to humiliate her and dehumanize her. This wasn't the first time officers had seen violence and murder involving a sex worker. They took pictures and notes about where she was found and how she was positioned, as it was a little different from what they normally see in these situations. But what the coroner found was unprecedented. The coroner reported that her eyes were missing, and when presented to the officers, they tried to explain this away, that sometimes they have to look deeper, that sometimes they roll back. The coroner takes a second look, making an even closer inspection, and found that not only were her eyes missing, but they had been removed with pristine surgical precision, setting a far darker tone to this investigation. What and who were they dealing with? Who could do such a thing? With no leads, officers turned to the women who worked alongside Mary for insight, and they come across a woman with fresh wounds on her neck and her face. Her name is Veronica Rodriguez. Now, I read mixed things on this, but what is consistent is that Veronica told officers that her services were requested, but things went south and she had to run for her life. She was bloody and covered in mud and escaped to a friend's house, and she is adamant that this friend had saved her life, that this was a good man that protected her. For whatever reason, though, when he was questioned 2 days later, he would not confirm the details or the story that Veronica provided, more than likely because he used her services as well and was afraid of an arrest. The officers keep her story and they take his information as well and leave it at that. 2 months later, February 1991, on the same street that Mary was found, another body was found. Susan Peterson was found the exact same way as Mary. She had been shot, found partially nude, and posed. When detectives working the case got the call of how she was found, they immediately asked them to check her eyes. It was then confirmed that her eyes had been removed as well, with the same surgical precision as Mary. Officers are more than sure that they are now dealing with a serial killer. A serial killer who has patience, isn't afraid of looking at the victim once she's deceased, and isn't okay with the gore that comes along with removing parts. They begin to warn the other working women that they are being targeted and hope to deter them from walking the streets. But unfortunately, because most of these women are working the streets out of necessity and addiction, it was easier said than done. Hardly any of them took heed to this warning. March 1991, a third body is found. This victim is identified as 45-year-old Shirley Williams, another sex worker. However, although she was posed and killed the same way as Mary and Susan, there were some differences as well. The first being that Shirley was black. The previous two victims, those sex workers, were white. She also was found completely nude this time, in a different residential neighborhood, sadly near a school, where children walking would see. They were able to connect her to the other two murders because her eyes had been removed as well. But this time, they could tell that the killer was rushing to remove her eyes. It was a sloppy job. There were nicks and marks from where he was fumbling and making errors as he did it. They even found a piece of the weapon used to remove them in her socket. It was an X-Acto blade. However, it isn't something that can point them to the killer or that they can link to anyone in any way. Shirley's murder spooked the other sex workers enough to where they all got off the street. Jefferson Boulevard, where they frequented at night, was now quiet and empty. When speaking with the other women again for more clues and insight, a woman named Brenda White comes forward. She had recently had an encounter with someone she felt could be this killer. She told the officers that she had been picked up by a white, muscular, older man and that he wanted to head to South Dallas. But she knew better than to travel that far with the client, so she declined. From what I learned after reading all these articles and everything, apparently sex workers have like a certain radius that they prefer to stay in. They don't like to venture outside. Which makes sense. You don't want to go outside your comfort zone. You know the area really well. You have escape routes, maybe. So I get that. So Veronica declines going with this man. This made him angry, and he began to threaten her. So she maced him and got out of the car. Upon hearing this, officers remember the story that Veronica Rodriguez told them. Her description matched Brenda's. So they go back to the man that Veronica said saved her. They notice that the address on his identification was not his house. He had rented it from a man named Charles Albright and was now renting a different property from the same landlord. Now, the man that saved Veronica does not match the description provided by either of the women. He's kind of small. Definitely can't overpower these girls for sure. He looks kind of wimpy. Nice guy, but you know, more of a pushover than an aggressor. But police do notice something. When they run Charles Albright's name, they notice that his properties are near where the bodies have been found. So they make an arrest. Now, who is Charles Albright? Charles Albright was born August of 1933 in Amarillo, Texas, and was immediately put up for adoption. He was adopted at 3 weeks old to a middle-class couple named Fred and Dale Albright. They lived in Oak Cliff, which at the time was considered a safe and lovely neighborhood of Dallas. Definitely not the same anymore, from what I understand. From what I understand, it's the opposite. They were a traditional nuclear family with Fred working and Dale staying home with Charles. Dale was a very loving and attentive mother, to a fault. She overparented, if that makes sense. She fussed over him constantly, didn't want him to get dirty. She did keep him out of trouble, made sure he had a healthy diet, and she did make sure he was well-mannered. But she hovered. But she did also have cruel and unusual punishment as well. If it was his nap or bedtime and he refused to go to sleep, she would just tie him down to the bed. Which, honestly, if you've ever seen Mommy Dearest, there's a part where she goes to get her brother out of bed and she unhooks like a harness. So I don't know if Dale was crazy or if this was just some weird shit from back then, because it could definitely be. I have no idea. But apparently, Dale's either Mommy Dearest or everybody was strapping their kids down for bed. I don't know. But also, even worse than being tied down to the bed to make sure he goes to sleep, was if he was misbehaving, she would lock him in a dark room. Definitely something that would have an impact on a child and on a psyche. The attention and the affection mixed with harsh punishments, I'm sure were confusing for him, and mixed up how he felt about his mother and made their relationship a little complex. But for the most part, he loved his mother, and both of his parents loved him. She had him practicing piano, but she also indulged in his hobby with him. That hobby being taxidermy, like a child would. I just want to know how they got to taxidermy. Was he already playing with dead animals and she just doesn't want to say that? Because that's the only way I feel like how you would be like, dead animals, let's do those. The reason why I say this is the way they got their animals to practice and, you know, develop his craft was they would go around the neighborhood and find dead animals, whether it be roadkill or dead by nature. And that's what they would use. So, however, Charles's mom was a frugal woman. She liked to save where she could. And she found it unnecessary to buy the marble eyes that you normally see in taxidermy. And what that means is when young Charles was creating and working on his project, when it came time to choose which eyes complement the animal, which fit the animal, what matches the animal, he had to settle on buttons for eyes from his mother's button collection. We know this had an impact on him even as a child, because it's reported that he would go to the taxidermy supply stores and just run his hands through all of the marble eyes. Just running them through, wanting to have at least one, if not all, the eyes. Very creepy. Picture that. A little boy, possibly in suspenders. A little young Sheldon, basically. That's how I picture him, real dorky. Just instead of comic books, eyeballs. Okay. So anyway, okay. Aside from the weird hobby, Charles was relatively normal and definitely above average mentally. He performed very well in school and showed a lot of promise. But as he got older, the cracks started to show. He began to commit robberies and petty theft crimes, this landing him a 2-year prison sentence. While he was in custody, a PO interviewed Charles and was completely caught off guard by Charles's capability of detaching from truth and reality. He could just dismiss reality and convince himself on something different. Charles only served 1 year of his sentence and was released at 17. He then went on to attend a teacher's college in Arkansas, and he excelled. He was a great student. He gets good grades, he's involved in school activities, he's social, and he makes the football team when he's never played an organized sport before. Athletically, he's good, he's a natural. Which kind of bothers me that he's definitely one of those people who's just good at everything that he tries and he's smart. Like, ugh, what a waste. Anyway, I digress. I get a little bitter. I'm not bad at things, but I was never like the best. But that's okay. He was also known as a prankster, something he was known for in high school and continued on into college. His most memorable prank in college being that one of his friends had a beautiful girlfriend with beautiful eyes, but she broke up with his friend. Now, I saw two different stories on what happened here, so I'm going to tell you both because I think they're both very Charles, both weird, and both good, honestly. I honestly couldn't choose as to like which one to go with. I think you should hear both. The first was that when Charles's friend was dumped, he was upset and he tore the pictures he had of the now ex-girlfriend. Charles then goes through the trash, finds the pictures, cuts her eyes out, and puts them all over. So everywhere his friend looks, in the restroom, in his bedroom, his ex-girlfriend's eyes are watching him. Now the other story I saw was that again after Charles's friend threw out the pictures of his ex-girlfriend, Charles recovered the photos. Then went ahead and pasted her eyes over pictures of his friend's new girlfriend. Whichever one is true, all accounts say that this was hilarious to his friends. Everyone thought it was just harmless fun. We know now that he probably had a fixation on this girl's eyes too. I honestly think those pranks are hilarious. If it was just, you know, a person who didn't murder someone, that's fucking funny. But instead, it's very gross. But this grand student would really turn out to be a dud. He would go on to amount to nothing but a criminal. He could never keep a job. He would lose interest and grow bored rather quickly. He constantly lied. Somehow, he was able to get married and father a child, and they separated, probably because of everything listed above. Can't keep a job, fucking lies all the time. Nobody wants to deal with that shit. At one point, he even forged credentials to get a teaching job at a high school. And he gets caught with this as well and gets fired. So after this, he continues his life of robbery and petty theft. In 1981, his mother, Dale, dies unexpectedly while cooking dinner. She had cancer. This causes Charles to come back home and spend more time with his father, and he starts to attend church. Soon, he becomes a beloved member of the church and takes to one particular family. They spend a lot of time together. They became great friends. But this only lasts until about 1982, when they discover that Charles has been sexually assaulting their 9-year-old daughter. The reason that this never went public was for the family being concerned of their daughter's well-being if this turned into a trial and became a public matter. So Charles took a plea bargain and was put on probation, making it to where his face never came into the papers, nothing. Then eventually Charles meets a woman named Dixie, a widow. Charles, being so charismatic and a tenured liar, he had Dixie convinced that she was with a good man, a provider. And sadly, I mean, she couldn't have been more wrong, honestly. See, at this point, Charles had inherited a number of rental properties from his parents, making him even more capable of living two different lives. He continued his crime and was also cheating on her. What Dixie didn't know was that when Charles would drop her off at work, instead of heading home, he would go to the motels that were frequented by sex workers. He would request their services, but he would also build a rapport with many of them. Oh, he'd tell them that he wanted them to better themselves. He would buy them food. He would try to keep them safe. He would even buy them drugs. he earned a lot of these women's trust. However, there were some that also encountered his dark side. Those that did said he would tie them up, belittle and berate them, and beat them. But aside from these unfortunate women, no one knew the real Charles. Everyone saw this charming, fun, well-to-do Charles. But he was somebody completely different. So when Charles is arrested for the murders, they search the entire house that he is staying in and his other properties. They find nothing directly tying him to anything, which is just such a bummer. They find multiple firearms, but none match what was used on the victims. They find X-Acto blades, but those can't be linked together. But, it wouldn't be a weirdo without weird shit, right? They do find pickled snakes, pickled pig eyes, pickled newts, and some other weird pickled animal shit. Weird. No eyeballs are recovered. I feel horrible saying that, but they were in search for that too, because that's a link. That's just not something people put on the shelf. So a crazy coincidence of the search in Charles's house is when officers are searching in his house, one finds a baseball cap and turns it over out of curiosity and learns that he plays on the same softball team as the man whose house they're searching. And that is how he realizes who's under investigation. And when he runs into Charles at the precinct, he's on his way to the lab. Charles is like, hey, come give me a hug. Again, completely detached from why he's there. He probably was also very arrogant and thought they had nothing on him. Because the sad part was they didn't. They recover nothing useful. But then a tip comes in. And they're led back to where Shirley's body was recovered. And they find a raincoat with an unidentifiable hair. A hair that matches hair found in Charles's vacuum. I had no idea they even checked vacuums. It makes sense, but I just would have never considered this at all. This hair is so uncommon. It's like a foreign entity to the lab. They actually take it to the zoo to see if they can identify it. And they do. They learn it belongs to a squirrel. Something Charles would use for taxidermy. Finally, a direct link to Charles. And this leads to Charles being charged with first degree murder for the murder of Shirley Williams. He is found guilty and he's sentenced to life. However, he is only charged for Shirley Williams' murder. They were never able to tie him to Mary and Susan's murder specifically. But they knew he did those too. Charles Albright did spend the rest of his life in prison. Alone and away from everyone else so he could never hurt anybody else. And he died on August 22nd, 2020. Good fucking riddance. And that is the story of Charles Albright. Please don't forget to like, follow, subscribe, comment, anything to get this podcast out there, this channel out there. It's much appreciated. But I thank you for joining me. And please remember that evil looks just like us. Okay, bye.